We're going to call the redistricting committee to order right now. Members, I think the first thing that we're going to do on our agenda is approve the minutes. And do I have someone that's willing to approve the minutes?
Someone, Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo moves the minutes from April 12th. We're going to make one slight adjustment to the minutes. If you look on line 2, it says April 12th of 2001. We need to change that to April 12th of 2011. So Representative Garofalo renews his motion to amend or approve the minutes from April 12th, 2011 as amended. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails.
Good thing I voted.
Good thing you voted. That was resounding. Okay. Members, just to kind of give you an idea of what we're going to be doing today, we are discussing the redistricting principles. These are the guidelines that we use in putting together both the legislative and congressional district maps for the state of Minnesota. And first, what we're going to do is we've got House File 1547 that's on the docket. And what we're going to do is first walk through the Delete Everything Amendment, which is DE1 to House File 1547. And then we'll proceed from there. So that's kind of a roadmap for you. So I'm going to start off by going through this. If everyone can pull out their DE1 amendment to House File 1547. First, I'm going to move House File 1547. And I'm also going to move the DE1 amendment to House File 1547. Members, what this language does is Minnesota has a couple of different constitutionally required requirements when it comes to the redistricting process. And if you look at Section 2 of the DE1 amendment, that's dealing with the nesting and Section Number 5 and the numbering. Both the nesting and numbering provisions in this DE1 amendment are required by our Minnesota Constitution. If you actually look at Article 4, Section 3 of the Minnesota Constitution, that is a requirement for us to make sure that when we're putting together a legislative district map, that two House districts reside in one single Senate district. So that's the nesting part of it. And then it also requires that we number our Senate districts in a regular series. So that's what Sections 2 and Section 5 do in this bill. Then if you move on to subdivision 3, talking about equal population, it's very important for us to make sure that we try to stick as close as possible to the one person, one vote criteria. And so we have a deviation of not more than 1% plus or minus in the equal population section of this bill. And that's an overall range of 2% then. And that applies both to the legislative district plan and the congressional plan when we get to that portion. And then when we are looking at subdivision 4 of the amendment, we're dealing here with contiguity and compactness. Again, this is an issue area where it's something that we have seen in redistricting principles for many cycles. And so we put that in here as well. And if you turn the page and you're on page 2 of the DE1 amendment, we've got the minority representation clause. We heard from many different groups that came before our committee during this whole process talking about the need to make sure that we preserve the Voting Rights Act here in the state of Minnesota, and this section does that. It's probably the most strongest language that we've had here in the state of Minnesota. I think that's key to having this in our redistricting principles. As far as Subdivision 7, that is dealing with minor civil divisions. So we're talking about counties and cities and townships. And we heard from several different communities throughout the last 4 months asking that we try to not unduly divide these communities, and it kind of ties in with the community of interest, which is the subdivision 8. Those two are connected in the sense that we're trying to keep these communities whole. If you look at subdivision 8 in greater detail, we outline different recognizable areas of similar interest, which include but are not limited to the racial, ethnic, geographic, social, or cultural interests. So that's the portion on communities of interest. And then subdivision 9 is dealing with data to be used, which we've had many conversations about, and that's using the PL data that we received from the Census Bureau. We received that back in March. And then as far as subdivision 10 goes, that just gives directions so that we make sure that we're comparing apples to apples when we're looking at different redistricting plans. And it says that we have a similar process handled through our Geographic Information Systems Office. Then when you look at subdivision 11, priority of principles, we're ranking the principles that we have here as they're listed. And then finally, you go to the very end of the delete everything amendment, and that just puts an effective date on this with an expiration as well. Members gave a lot of thought to this criteria that we put together. We have been fortunate in the last 4 months that we have had 13 hearings to hear from the citizens, to hear from local elected officials, to hear from different groups, anywhere from the we had the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, the Council on Black Minnesotans, the Chicano Latino Affairs Council, the African Development Center of Minnesota. We reached out to the different tribes within the state of Minnesota. We had the League of Women Voters come and testify. We had the Native Vote Alliance of Minnesota come in, Outfront Minnesota, the Cedar Humphrey Action for Neighborhood Collaborative Engagement. We had the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits testify. We had the Minnesota Association of Townships come in. We had the Minnesota School Boards Association come in. The League of Minnesota Cities, the Minnesota Association of County Officers. We also sent out letters to every single county, city, and township in the state of Minnesota. We sent out notification to every media outlet that we had available to us, notifying them, encouraging them to make sure that they notified the public about the redistricting process. We're fortunate in the fact that with the census having just been taken place last year, people were aware that this was happening and encouraged folks to participate in this process as much as possible. And we have also traveled to Greater Minnesota. We had 3 tours. We visited the communities of Marshall, Rochester, and Hermantown. So we have done extensive research and have gotten some wonderful feedback from citizens on this issue, and it's the result of all of that work that brought us to the Delete Everything Amendment that we have before us today. And with that, I'll renew my motion on the Delete Everything Amendment and ask if members have any questions.
I have a question.
Representative Hortman. And actually, Representative Hortman, let's do this first. I think what we'll do first is you do have some amendments. Representative Murphy, you have some amendments that you wanted to do as well. We should probably, we'll do questions first and then we'll go to there. Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering when your amendment was posted on the web and if it made your 24-hour deadline.
Yes, actually, Representative Hortman, it was posted at 11:30.
Yesterday?
Yesterday.
Mm-hmm. There was no notice mailed out to members of the committee that there was going to be a delete all amendment. And so, you know, I spent the weekend working on amendments to your bill as you had it drafted. Mm-hmm. And so I know that we are going to have a long process today as we go through the amendments. But I did want to just speak a little bit to the process. You sort of outlined what I think you think has been a very thorough and very open process. And I think that this particular amendment sort of typifies the problems we've had in this committee of not having advance notice of hearings. 8 times the committee notices have come 5 days or less before the committee's had a hearing. A few of those times has been 3 days notice. 4 different times we had 3 days notice for a committee hearing. And we haven't had the kind of outreach that I think we should have had to really have a robust plan where all sorts of Minnesotans from all parts of the state have really had a full and meaningful opportunity to provide input. It's one thing to have a website. It's one thing to go to 3 rural, homogeneous population areas. It's another thing to do a comprehensive outreach where you go to suburbs, you go to cities, you hear from different types of populations in the state. I definitely give you a lot of credit for sending the letters out and asking for that kind of input, but I think your perspective on what sort of process we've had so far and my perspective on what sort of process we've had so far is very, very different. And I, you know, we're going to move forward and adopt your amendment, and then we'll do some discussion on the language by way of the other amendments that we'll be offering. But I think that the process is a little lacking. I think for the public to come in and have a meaningful opportunity to provide input on a your proposal, which has now it has principles, some principles in it, when the committee hearing was noticed and the bill was put out, there were really very few. There were only the minimal constitutional requirements. So people really didn't have a fair, full opportunity to come and provide meaningful input on the language that you've put before us today. And I think part of the problem with that is going to make things take a little longer today, but I just wanted to mention that. I was actually surprised to hear that it met the deadline. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hortman, and we're going to have to agree to disagree on this issue. We have House rules in place that state that when it comes to notifying of a meeting, you have a three-day rule. We went beyond that on this committee hearing. You knew about this committee hearing. You knew that criteria was going to be discussed. You received a five-day notice. That's 2 days more than what is required of us on the House rules. And if I remember correctly, I don't remember you on the House floor offering an amendment to the House rules to make it 5 days, 10 days, or 2 weeks. You voted on an issue of a three-day rule notice, which we have had for as long as I can remember, which is 15 years worth. So if you were truly concerned about the notice part, I would have expected you to have made a motion to amend the rules on a three-day notice. You received 5-day notice for this committee hearing. We have committee rules in place, which you are well aware of. This amendment was posted 25 hours in advance. I spoke with Representative Murphy last week. I said, yeah, by the way, we're going to be talking about criteria. Asked for her input. And so that's the process that we've had, and I'm just going to have to respectfully disagree with you on this. Members, any other questions? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just as a point of note, I was on the road last Thursday in my district doing town halls and had my BlackBerry and can go through the emails and go to the House website and so forth. And I noticed then that evening that when I got home that the notice was posted for this committee meeting. So no disrespect to Representative Hortman in any way, shape, or form. We're the dog sleds. We've gotten rid of those, and we've moved on to technology and stuff. So if we can do it in Rosa, we can certainly do it down here. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fabian. Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, point of personal privilege.
State your point of personal privilege.
I appreciate the call that I received from you last week on Wednesday. And it was a general conversation, and it was my impression that you were asking for inputs on maps. And I said we had been working on the principles. But even then, Madam Chair, you did not say the meeting on Monday was going to be about the principles. And so it was not until the committee notice that came the next day on Thursday that I knew there was going to be principles. So I presumed that it was going to be on 1547, the bill, and 1546, the two bills that you had introduced on Monday. I did not know about the DE amendment until yesterday afternoon. So, Madam Chair, the amendments that were offered or were put in on Monday were the result of the notification that we received on April 26th based on House File 1547 and 1546. And several of the committee members worked independently. And then I was notified by Ms. Connolly this morning that even one of our amendments was not accepted because it didn't make the timeline. So we do have communication issues that have to be improved upon. I think part of it was that the communication had to come electronically to all of us because we weren't here. But the principles are something that Representative Hortman talked about at this committee meeting last week, but we've mentioned several times throughout the issue, when are we going to have them? And now that we've got them, we're supposed to get done in an hour. And I just feel that we don't have quite enough time. But that being so, we do have questions to ask about the individual
Representative,
that you're presenting to us today.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. And, you know, I appreciate your feedback on that. However, as I mentioned earlier, we have gone beyond what is required of us when it comes to House rules and notification. I listened to the comments that I received last week. Last Monday that we met, when Representative Horton raised the issue that we should be discussing criteria. So this is the committee hearing that we're discussing criteria. However, this is not new. We have been discussing principles/criteria since January 18th. That has been part of the overall process, 4 months worth of discussing principles and criteria here. So I'm just glad that it all came together here today and that we're having the opportunity to do it again one more time.
Thank
so
you, Chair.
With that, Representative Murphy, do you have any questions on the delete everything amendment?
Yes, I do.
You may proceed.
I think that it would serve us very well if we went through them subdivision by subdivision. And if
that
we
you have questions on each subdivision?
And an explanation of what the subdivision is saying.
I tell you what we'll do, Representative Murphy, is Representative, Mr. Gehring, if you'll go through each section. I don't know if you were here, Representative Murphy. I did go through each subdivision, but we can have Mr. Gehring, if you can go through that, and we'll start with you, please. If you could start with subdivision one, Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Gehring, I understand the titles, but I would like an explanation of the wording which explains the titles.
Mr. Gehring.
A summary of the wording which explains the titles.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, Madam Chair, should I just read? So subdivision one is the applicability subdivision of the bill. So this specifies that the principles that are contained in the section here are going to apply to both legislative and congressional districts that are adopted by the committee. Subdivision two is the nesting provision. This is basically saying that House districts must be nested within a Senate district so that you don't have you'll be setting up Senate districts and dividing the Senate districts into two House districts each. Subdivision 3 is the equal population requirement. Paragraph A of Subdivision 3 provides that legislative districts have to be substantially equal in population, and there's an allowance for a deviation of up to 1% plus or minus from the ideal population, and then the specific population numbers are provided for House and Senate districts in Paragraph A. In paragraph
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, on that, have you double-checked the numbers?
Representative Murphy, are you referring to the House district consisting of 39,582 people?
That and the 79,164.
Representative Murphy, those are correct, yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Gehring, please proceed.
Madam Chair.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I guess we're all new to this probably, but I think back in 2002, they went with a 2% deviation. And my first question is, what has kind of been that deviation percent in the past? Because I think last, in 02, it was 2%, I believe. If, I don't know if Mr. Gearing could
answer. Representative Marquardt, 10 years ago, the House plan was at 0.75%. And I believe that the Senate plan was at 2%. So we are 0.25% above the what we had from 10 years ago.
Madam Chair.
Representative Marquardt.
But the fact is, I think for the last 40 years, it's been the courts and not the legislature. So I guess I'm wondering what the courts have had to say about this, what's actually been in practice, not what bills have been passed, but what actually has been in practice. And well, at least 10 years ago, if, I don't know how far back we can go, but I guess I'd like to know a little bit of the history of that number.
Sure.
Madam Chair.
Well, Mr. Marquardt.
I'm sorry. My apologies, Madam Chair.
Just one moment, please. Representative Marquardt, actually the overall range for the courts, the last time that they did it was 1.56 percent. That was the overall range. We're at an overall range in this piece of legislation of 2%. So the courts were at an overall range of 1.56%. Representative Garofalo, did you have anything to add to that at all?
Well, just Madam Chair and Representative Marquardt, and when people ask questions that have historically inaccurate propositions, and I feel the need to make sure that members don't assume the assumption of the question is accurate. My first point you addressed with regards to the deviation of the courts. The second was is that my friend, Representative Marquardt, alluded to the fact that the courts have drawn the lines for four decades. That's not true. The 1990 redistricting plan that was enacted was actually passed by the legislature, and the governor failed to act on that action. So I just want to make sure that members are well informed about the historical accuracies or inaccuracies of my colleague's statements.
Very good.
Representative Marquardt, any further
thank
questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is right. I think 1990 was one, or 92, that the veto was not made in time or something like that. But I think probably at least, Mr. Gearing could say, more times than not, it's been decided by the courts. And then also on the deviation number, are we talking about plus or minus 2% of the number, or is it plus or minus 1%, so you're getting 2% range?
Sure.
What is that?
Representative Marquardt, it is a 2% range. It's a plus or minus 1%.
So, Madam Chair, if I could go back to what did the court determine back in 2002? Was it a plus or minus 2%, which was a 4% deviation, or just so we're talking apples to apples?
It wasn't actually, Representative Marquardt.
Or 1.56, whatever, if we could get that answer.
You can verify, Mr. Gearing, but it was 1.56%, and you look at the legislative district map that the courts put together, it was a 1.56% overall range. But, Mr. Gearing, you want to verify that for us, please?
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, when the court adopted principles for establishing districts in the 2001 process, one of their principles was that legislative plans are not to exceed a maximum population deviation of plus or minus 2%. So that have been a total 4% range that they allowed in districts and plans that were submitted to the court. The ultimate plan that was enacted by the court at that time had a deviation range of 0.8% plus or minus.
Madam Chair?
Representative Marquardt.
I've been given page 3, and I think you mentioned this, Mr. Gearing, of the looks like the special redistricting panel court order. But on page 3, it says the plans will not exceed a maximum population deviation of plus or minus 2%. Is that what you gave to me first, Mr. Gearing?
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, yes, that's correct.
Yeah, and then just to clarify, then the second thing you said was what? It was a little different.
So the 0.8% is the deviation that was actually enacted by the court's plan. So the 2% deviation is the principle that they established for their goal for establishing plans, and then when they finally completed their maps, they had a deviation of 0.8%.
Mr. Gearing, that's rounding up, isn't it? Because it was actually 0.75 something, isn't it correct?
Madam Chair, the number that could be the number I have here is 0.8%.
So yeah, it was rounded up because it was 0.75.
Madam Chair.
So, Representative Marquardt.
And today we're talking principles, not what actually may wind up. And it looks like according to this court order, that the principal was a plus or minus 2%. I recognize what Mr. Gearing said is that what we wound up with was much closer, and we could wind up much closer this time. But the fact of the matter of where you're starting can make a huge difference as far as flexibility in some other areas. And I guess I'm just wondering if, in fact, what was done at least 10 years ago was a plus or minus, in principle, 2%, what's the rationale to going to a plus or minus 1% this year?
Well, Representative Marquardt, I think the principle behind it is that we are given the responsibility to stick as close as possible to equal representation for the citizens of the state of Minnesota, in all fairness to them, so that they know that their vote counts as much as their neighbor down the street does. So I think that's the principle behind having this as tight as we can. And as I mentioned earlier, this isn't, the courts were at 0.756, I think, is what they did. Now, we have some other principles that we want to try to account for. For us, you know, we heard testimony from different communities of wanting to keep their, whether it's the county or their cities, whole. We think that that's a value that's important. And so we've done a collection of these different principles and put them together in a package that we think will work overall and still help to get that equal population criteria in there. So that's the logic behind it, Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a question, because I think by having a little more flexibility, it may prevent us from dividing cities and townships and other things in half. And I'm just wondering if someone could say, what would be the impact of going from a 2% to a 1%? Would there be more or less dividing of cities into like two different legislative districts? Rural Minnesota, we've got, in my district I represent, there's a city of Rotse. Of course, it's divided between counties, but it has two, you know, legislative districts. And I know there's many other examples around. And I'm just, and I think, you know, citizens certainly want, one vote, one person, one vote. But at the same time, I don't know if they want their communities divided up into different legislative districts. And I'm thinking that the less flexibility we allow, the more likely that would be to occur. And I don't know if there's anything to back that up, but is there anyone, I don't know if Mr. Gearing could answer. I mean, what is the likelihood of the less flexibility you have of the higher chances of dividing, communities of interest and cities and townships into two different districts? I don't know that answer, but I'm thinking it probably would actually increase the likelihood of that.
All right. Well, Representative Marquardt, I think Representative Fabian, did you want to comment to that point? Or
I couldn't resist. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Marquardt, you talk about rural districts. Well, I'm in a rural district as well, and my district that I represent is just under 4,000 square miles. And when you take a look across the top of the state in the other districts that border Canada, in Cook County, for example, in the district over there in Arrowhead, I believe that's 9 to 10,000 square miles. Under the when we look at the congressional districts drawn, those districts are drawn down to the person. I think it would be in the citizens' best interest to have a fairly narrow range to make sure that their representatives are more responsive to them. I think it's certainly possible to make sure that we don't split communities along those lines. I'm not sure how big you want some of our rural districts to be in terms of square miles. They're already huge, and I think that the possibility of disenfranchising some voters by going to plus or minus two with a spread of four increases, in my opinion, possibly the odds of that happening. And that's kind of my take on the narrower range.
Madam Chair?
Representative Marquardt.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, Representative Fabian. By the way, Representative Fabian, you don't have any Canadian provinces into your district that got put in there, hopefully.
And I'm not going to raise your property taxes either today.
But, you know, I'm thinking about the city of Moorhead. And I think in another 3 or 4 years, Oakport Township to the north, where they're doing flood control projects, is going to be annexed and become part of Moorhead. And it may work out. I think Moorhead was 38,000 some, and Oakport's, I mean, they're going to be really close to that. I mean, I don't know if you add those two up. I think they're going to be over 40,000. But if you're at just 1%, that only gives you about 400 leeway, where 2% give you about 800 population leeway, I'm thinking. My math is correct. And these are the situations I'm looking at, is if you had to divide where Oakport's going to be annexed into Moorhead, in that example, you just have lost that extra leeway. And again, I don't know this for a fact, but I'm just thinking, unless someone can say otherwise, that the more restrictive it is, the more likelihood of splitting up communities and political subdivisions into two legislative districts. And I don't know if anyone can answer that question. I mean, I'm just trying to think of it logically. And if I'm off base on that, but that's why go to such a limit of 1% when, you know, the principle is 2%. You can try to get right on the money if you can, but there's going to be some situations where by adding another 100 population, you can take in this township or take in the rest of this city. And I just don't understand why you'd want to be so restrictive. And first of all, can anyone answer the question of, am I on base there, that the more restrictive, the more likely that a political subdivision would get divided, or maybe that doesn't matter?
Well, Representative Marquardt, you know, I don't know, I assume that you received this. If you haven't, it is in your packet. But we did receive a letter from the governor's office just yesterday. And the number one item that he had on his list of districting principles is to achieve the smallest deviation possible to ensure every citizen has an equal voice in electing their representatives. So we agree with Governor Dayton that we should do that. We understand that the courts were able to do this 10 years ago. And when the courts drew up their plan, they had only 50 counties split and 46 cities split, which outdid the splits that you saw in the Senate proposal from 10 years ago. And I think that's pretty remarkable, and then that is a priority for me, and that's why when you look on page 2, subdivision 7, we talk about counties and cities and town splits and trying to make sure that we minimize splitting up those communities.
And Madam
Representative
Chair,
Marquardt.
And I appreciate that very much. And I just think that we have to recognize that if we are going with a smaller number there, that the greater likelihood of splitting up communities are going to happen. So that when it does, as they're trying to do that, and after the map is out and people say, why are we divided up? You know, we've got to recognize that that might be the give and take on all of this.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Clark.
I'm just wondering if we could actually get an answer from Mr. Gehring, if he knows historically the impact of a smaller deviation.
Well, we can't ask Mr. Gehring to make an opinion on whether a deviation, a smaller deviation, will. I mean, that's putting him in a difficult position as nonpartisan staff. He can give you the history of the deviation that the both the legislative bodies and the courts have used, if that's helpful to you, Representative Clark.
Well, I guess the history and the history, I mean, we've just been talking about it, a question of how to really follow our principles. So I don't think we really got an answer to the question that was being asked, like, what is the impact? And maybe there's a historical answer. If there's a historical answer, then that's what I'd like to hear.
Mr. Gehring, can you tell us how many communities were split under the court's deviation of 0.8% plus or minus from 10 years ago?
Madam Chair, the court's plan that had the 0.8% deviation split for the House district boundaries split 50 counties and 40 minor civil divisions, which would be cities and townships. The Senate side of that plan split 31 counties and 25 minor civil divisions.
And Mr. Gehring, can you say the Senate numbers again, please?
The Senate splits were 31 counties and 25 minor civil divisions, and the House splits were 50 counties and 46 minor civil divisions.
Madam Chair?
And Mr. Gehring, I think that is a little, can you tell, that was for the Senate districts. Can you give us for the House districts, please?
So the House district boundaries split 50 counties and 46 minor civil divisions.
And that was for the courts, correct?
Correct.
And what for the Senator Pogelmiller's plan from 10 years ago? What were the splits that he had for House districts?
Madam Chair, I don't have that report in front of me, so I can find it for you.
If you could, and if you could share that with the rest of the committee.
Madam Chair.
Representative Clark.
Is it safe to say, based on just what we know so far, that the larger deviation allowed for fewer splits? That's what I think I'm understanding.
No. Representative Clark, we do not have a comparable number, correct? What was the... Mr. Gehring?
Madam Chair, I need to find the number.
Okay, and he'll get back to us. Very good. Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know the court order from 2002 said that the mean deviation for the planned Senate district was 0.28, and the mean deviation for the planned House districts was 0.32. But that doesn't mean that in every case that the deviation wasn't up to the 2% that was allowed. So do you have a grid at all that would show in how many House districts they were bigger than 1%?
Representative Hortman, we can have Mr. Gehring get you that data, but the overall range that the courts used in the plan that they drafted 10 years ago that's in place right now was 1.56%.
So if I understand so you correctly, then
plus or minus 0.75 in some numbers.
There's no House district that is more than 0.75% bigger than the smallest House district?
It's the range between the two, Representative Hortman, and so the overall range is 1.56%.
I think it'd be useful for us to see that data because... I'm not certain that that's the case. I remember looking at those numbers in 2002. But the other point I wanted to make about the 1% deviation rather than 2 is that there are areas that are projected to grow. Their population is projected to grow. And so in other places where the population is projected to shrink. So when you have the deviation smaller, you give the court or this legislature less ability to take a look at rapidly growing areas. And you actually undermine your goal of providing the most equal representation possible by not being able to take into account that growth factor.
Madam Chair?
Representative Groffel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to my friend, Representative Hortman, I just want to make sure I understand this for the record. You're saying that in a redistricting process, growing communities like mine and exurban and collar counties, that it would be a fair principle to have those districts come in at smaller district sizes than other districts in rural Minnesota and urban areas of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth? Are you saying that's a good principle that would for decision makers?
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, Representative Garofalo, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is when you're looking at drawing a map and you have lines that you're trying to put in the fairest place possible, respecting communities of interest and political subdivisions, that if you have some flexibility in your population range, and you have an area where you know you're going to grow, having that flexibility allows you to do a more precise job that will last over time.
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, Representative Hartman, I think you just said what I said, and that is that you are saying a variable of projected growth in the future should be a consideration for the size of district lines, and that variable of a high growth area would be, in your opinion, a reasonable characteristic for having a district be smaller than other districts. You said, I mean, the variable is the growth factor. Outside of that, I mean, do you think growth factor, outside of any other consideration, is a valuable, valid metric for having a district be smaller than other ones?
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Garofalo, no, you got to it there, your last point there. That variable alone is not meaningful. When you're looking at where is a county line, where is a city line, how do you nest districts properly, it is one thing that when this committee or a court, should we fail, looks at how to put together a fair districting plan, they have more flexibility in looking at all those factors if the population range is larger.
Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Hartman, just to be clear then, so as a basket of factors, a factor that a community is going to be growing, in your opinion, is a reasonable metric for having a district be undersized compared to other districts. As a basket of factors, that's one of the valid considerations that, that decision makers should make.
Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that is one of the basket of factors that the court talked about in 2002 on the edges.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, do you think that the deviation standard has anything to do with the administration of elections? The costs of administering the elections?
Representative Murphy, can you give me a little...
If there's a smaller deviation, if there's 1% deviation rather than 2%?
Can you give me a little more information, Representative Murphy, on what you're trying to say?
If a city or a precinct was split, would there have to be two election sites?
Well, Representative Murphy, when you go through the map-making process, you don't actually go by the existing precincts because those will change. Once we establish maps on the legislative and the congressional level, and we do that on a census block level, then the local units of government will come in and they'll redraw all of their precinct boundary lines.
Does it have an effect then on the county's administration of elections?
Well, Representative Murphy, they're in the same boat, that they will redraw their county commissioner lines and so forth, but I think Representative Dowd has some experience with that. Representative Dowd?
Yeah, one of my cities, the city of Cambridge, actually is divided into two precincts, and they hold their elections in the same location, the city hall. So they have two separate precincts in one location.
Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dowd, do they report their, they have independent precincts or calculations of the vote tallies and so forth, right? They're separate until they, then the city reports them to the county?
Representative Dowd.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, that's correct. They have the staff in that location, and they basically divide that location into two precincts. So the same number of people goes and votes there as when they were one precinct. And then when they tally the results, they tallied as two precincts, and they report those results back to the county auditor as two separate precincts. Yeah.
Any other questions, members?
I have another question, Mr. Gary.
Representative Murphy.
Subdivision 3.
Let's just pause a moment. Is there anybody else that has any other questions while Mr. Gearing is getting the data? Now we hear the Jeopardy theme music right now, so. Mr. Gearing, Representative Murphy has a question for you, and if we'll give him a moment to get into his chair. Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Representative Gearing, back to Subdivision 3A. What was the population of the state that you were using when you calculated populations for a Senate district was 79,164?
Mr. Gearing.
Or maybe, Madam Chair, somebody else did the calculation.
Mr. Gearing?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, the numbers came from what the state demographer presented in our committee hearings around the state. So the number is, or the total state population would be 39,582 times 134.
But the total 2010 census of the state, the population.
Mr. Gearing?
$5 million something.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, population is 5,303,988, with some possible rounding in there.
Representative Murphy? And Representative Murphy, these are the numbers that were provided to us, too, by the State Demographer's Office. But we do...
5,303,988. Thank you.
Mr. Gearing?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, correct.
And Representative Clark, we do have an answer to your question that you had. Mr. Gearing, do you want to report those numbers, please? We're comparing both the Senate plan from 10 years ago had a 2% plus or minus deviation compared to the court. So if you can do it first, the Pogue-Miller plan compared to the court plan on Senate districts, and then the Pogue-Miller's plan on House districts compared to the court plan on House districts. Mr. Gearing, do you have those numbers? If not, I have them.
Madam Chair, I have the deviation from the Pogue-Miller plan for the House districts, which included an overall range of 3.52%, which was a deviation of plus or minus 1.86% in the Pogue-Miller plan from 2001.
And we were looking at the county and city splits.
I don't have the county and city splits.
Okie dokie. You have that report. Just one moment, Representative Hortman. When we're looking at the Senate plan from 10 years ago, this is, and we'll make sure that every member has a copy of this for your own purposes, but when you're looking at the Pogue-Miller plan from 10 years ago for Senate districts, the splits were 49 county, 51 city. In comparison to the court plan, which they had a deviation of 0.75 and so forth percent, they split 31 counties and 25 cities. So the Senate plan was 49 counties to the court's 31 counties. On the cities, it was from the Senate plan 51 cities split to the court plan of 25 cities split. When you're looking at House districts under the Senate plan, they split 64 counties, and the court plan split 50. And on the city plan under the Senate, it was 84 cities that were split compared to the court plan of 46 cities split. But like I said, we will make sure that you have a copy of this report. Representative Dowd, you had a question?
Yeah, Madam Chair. I was trying to follow along with that as you were saying it. So what you're saying is the court used a lower deviation? And they split less municipalities and counties?
Yes, Representative Dowd, that is correct.
Okay, just wanted to be clear on that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Clark.
Do we know, because we're not just talking about, political subdivisions when we're trying to develop these districts, we're talking about, in your own bill, too, you certainly respect that, the minority populations and communities of interest. Do we know the impact of changing that? It's from 2% to 1%. Do we know the impact on those considerations? I mean, that'd be one thing, I guess, I think we'd want to know about. And I don't know if anyone has taken the time to look at that, but that certainly would be a question. And I can also say one other thing, representing an inner city district, we don't have, more than one county or various townships, we have neighborhoods, which are political subdivisions, actually, in many cases. They have voting powers to advise our city councils and so on. And so I'm very interested when we get into a very dense population that we also have the ability to have the kind of flexibility we need. Sometimes you get a senior high-rise, for example, has one cluster might have 300, 400 people in it. So I'm trying to understand if we have any knowledge beyond also the cities and counties and townships, also the other considerations that we're concerned about, minority representation, preserving those interests, and some of the neighborhoods.
we call them district councils in St. Paul and Minneapolis, their district. So I'm just wondering if we have any information on that.
Representative Clark, that's an excellent question to ask, and certainly we'll be looking into it. Mr. Gehring, if you can help us get out some of that information, that would be helpful too. But that's one of the reasons why, Representative Clark, I put communities of interest as well as minority representation as part of our overall redistricting principles, because I do think it's important to preserve and respect the Voting Rights Act and respecting communities of interest as well.
So,
Representative Clark,
Madam Chair, thank you. At what point do you think we'll be able to get that information, whether about the impact of having a more restrictive number on those communities that were of interest, minority communities, so on?
Mr. Gehring?
Madam Chair, I don't know that we'll be able to necessarily draw a whole lot of conclusions, but what I can do is go print out all of the summary reports from the plans, from the court enacted plan, as well as the Bogomiller plan from 2001. We can compare those numbers, and if you give me a couple minutes, I can go do that right now.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. That would be great. Members, any other questions? Well, Representative Hortman.
Before he takes off, we were walking through the bill, and he was doing the walkthrough, so I don't know if we are going to stop and wait for the answer to the question
well,
before
you
we continue the walkthrough.
You're right, actually, Representative Hortman. That's a good point. And Representative Clark, if you're amenable to it, if we can ask Mr. Gehring to do that work and provide that information to you after the committee hearing, if that's acceptable to you, Representative Clark.
Madam Chair, so we would be voting without knowing the impact on communities of color, communities of interest, and more densely populated districts.
If that's, if you want to have the information, we can do that, but if we could please have Mr. Gehring finish walking through, and then once we get on to other questions okay. And he's freed up from that task,
yeah,
he can provide
fine.
You with the information at that point. Is that acceptable, Representative Clark?
No, that's fine. I just didn't want to vote without us having that information.
And Representative Marquardt?
Madam Chair, could we also ask Mr. Gehring to do a split on the House plan? We heard on the court plan and we heard the Senate, but I'd like to also hear what it was on the House plan also,
sure.
Because just of possibly comparing apples to apples a little closer there.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, I actually think Mr. Miller and Mr. Lawrence are both in the audience, and they can probably go print out all of the reports from those plans while I'm walking through the DE amendment.
Okay. It looks like they're going to do that. Thank you, Troy. Mr. Gehring, if you could proceed, please.
Madam Chair, just to clarify for Mr. Miller, we're looking for all the summary reports from the House and the Senate and the court plans from 2002. Madam Chair, so I think in the walkthrough where we left off was paragraph A of subdivision 3. Paragraph B is the population standards for congressional districts. We provide in the DE amendment that the congressional districts must be as nearly equal in population as practicable. And then the ideal population for congressional districts is listed there. So there's no deviation standard of any number for congressional districts. Subdivision 4 is the contiguity and compactness requirements. These are requirements that are provided in the Minnesota Constitution, so districts have to be composed of convenient and contiguous territory, and they have to be compact. In the software that creates the map or creates the districts, there are a number of calculations that you use to calculate compactness, and so those will appear on the reports that are generated with each plan. There's also specifications in Subdivision 4 related to contiguity. So contiguity by water is sufficient if a person is still able to travel across the district without having the water be a serious obstacle. This subdivision also provides that point contiguity is not sufficient. So if there's territory that is contiguous only at a specific point, that is not that would not meet the contiguity requirement of this subdivision. Subdivision 5 is related.
Mr. Gehring, if you could pause a moment. Representative Murphy, you have a question.
Madam Chair, in your House File 1547, you didn't have that point contiguity is not sufficient. And did you have additional information that came to you about that, or why is it added now in the DE?
Oh, well, Representative Murphy, that actually has been something that has been discussed in past redistricting years that we've had, as well as and you understand the point contiguity. I mean, you just you can't have a district where it's touching just by one point, and that's what equals that it's part of a district. So you could have just one point touching to make up a district. And I guess I just didn't assume that anybody would have any opposition to that. I think that was the original intent, and it just got left off of the original bill when I had this section in there. And I just wanted to make sure that we did not want to have point contiguity, that that we wanted to avoid that. Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, Subdivision 5 is related to numbering of districts. Paragraph A specifies the procedure for numbering legislative districts. Districts have to be numbered in a regular series. You start with House District 1A in the northwest corner of the state, and then you go from west to east and then north to south. The 11-county metro area is bypassed until you get to the very end. Once the rest of the state has been numbered, the 11-county metro area is numbered, and Minneapolis and St. Paul are numbered last. The 11-county metro area, for purposes of these principles, would include Anoka County, Carver County, Chisago County, Dakota County, Hennepin County, Isanti County, Ramsey County, Scott County, Sherburne, Washington, and Wright counties. And those are all counties that are within the metropolitan statistical area. That's a determination that's made at the federal level about what constitutes the metropolitan area in Minnesota. Numbering of congressional districts it's laid out in paragraph B, sort of the opposite of numbering of legislative districts. Congressional district numbers start with District 1 in the southeast corner of the state, and then they go north and west. Subdivision 6 establishes a principle related to minority representation. This paragraph A provides that the dilution of racial or ethnic minority voting strength is contrary to the laws of the United States and the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Gehring, if I can interrupt you one moment. Representative Doubt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe this is a question for you. Is the 11-county metro area a new thing? I am in one of those 11 counties, and I've got one of the old numbers. So is that something new? Was it 7 counties before?
Representative Doubt, 11 county area is actually been used by the Census Bureau. That has been their definition of the metro area, so we went with the Census Bureau's definition of the metro area. Mr. Gehring.
Subdivision 6 relates to minority representation. As I said, there's provisions in here to state that the state of laws are not meant to supersede any provision of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 as amended. It also provides that any redistricting plan may not have the intent or effect of dispersing or concentrating minority populations in a manner that prevents minority communities from electing candidates of their choice. Subdivision 7 is the subdivision that relates to splits of minor civil divisions, which are political subdivisions in Minnesota. It provides that counties, cities, and townships can't be unduly divided unless it's necessary to meet equal population requirements or to form districts that are convenient and contiguous territory. There are exceptions for what is not considered an undue division of a minor civil division, and that includes if a county or if a city or town is divided because the territory of that city or town has non-contiguous portions within it. So if a city or town has a little island of territory that's not connected to the rest of the city, and that little island is split in the creation of a district, that would not be an undue division of that city or town. Similarly, there's an allowance in here for divisions of political subdivisions if the division doesn't affect any known population of voters. So basically, if there is a territory that has zero population in it and that is split from the rest of the territory, that's considered an acceptable division. Subdivision 8 specifies handling of communities of interest and provides that districts should attempt to preserve identifiable communities of interest where that can be done in accordance with the other principles contained in this resolution. And the communities of interest include areas with similar interests, such as racial, ethnic, geographic, social, or cultural interests. Subdivision 9 relates to the data to be used in creating the districts. Basically, the data is the census population data that's been already submitted to the state and is in the hands of the GIS staff, subject to any errors that we may receive from the U.S. Census Bureau, or excuse me, corrections of errors that we receive from the U.S. Census Bureau. Subdivision 10 specifies that a redistricting plan will not be considered by the Senate or the House until a proper block equivalency file showing the district to which each census block has been assigned has been submitted to the director of the GIS office. So in other words, you need to have a complete plan that shows every single census block assigned to a specific district submitted to the GIS office before it can be considered in the House or the Senate. Subdivision 11 specifies the priority of principles. So to the extent that there are conflicts or difficulties in complying with all the principles contained in this bill, you start with principle number one and go sequentially through number eight. And the first principle takes the highest priority, and the eighth principle takes the last priority. And finally, there's an effective date specifying that these principles would apply to districts established for use in 2012, and then that this section of statute would expire June 1st, 2012. So these principles would only affect the redistricting process in this decade and not subsequent decades unless there's future legislative action to reenact them.
Members, any questions? If not, I'll renew my motion to amend House File 1547 with the DE1 amendment.
I do have a question.
Representative Clark.
Thank you. I'm just looking back at the preserving communities of interest. I think there's a new word in there that wasn't in the previous law, the word identifiable on line 2.18. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, Representative Clark. I couldn't hear you very well. Can you?
Okay. In the subdivision 8, preserving communities of interest, on line 2.18, the word identifiable is inserted, and I'm just wondering what the rationale for that is.
Well, Representative Clark, clearly you would want to make sure that you could identify it as a community of interest, and then it goes on to define what would be recognizable similarities of interest, and you see the list there. It's including but not limited to that list. It can't be where you and your neighbor both like green socks, and that makes you a community of interest. It's making sure that it is clearly identifiable to the public that this is a community, much like you had mentioned neighborhoods.
Well, how about it if me and my neighbors happen to be members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender community, and being identifiable is sometimes risky? So I'm just wondering if what your intention here is here, and if that does take that into consideration, how would it affect that group of people? There's also many other of my neighbors who are racial or ethnic minorities, and I don't know that they don't wear a tag that says, you know, I am Latino, you know, I am American Indian, and it may not be easily identifiable. So I'm trying to understand. It just seems like, I don't think it's been used before. If I'm wrong, correct me. If it has been used before, that's fine. But if it hasn't, I'm just wondering, what do we gain and what do we lose?
Oh, well, Representative Clark, this identifiable language is actually used 10 years ago in the House language that was passed off the House floor. When we're talking about minority representation, actually part of the data that we received from the Census Bureau in the PL file contains a breakout of the different minority groups within the state of Minnesota. We do have that information, and so that's helpful to us in this process. Representative Clark.
So are the minorities that identified the ones that are on the sheet?
Representative Clark, yes.
So I guess I just have to say again, I don't know, that doesn't include some of the other communities of interest, cultural, ethnic groups, social culture. Those are in the bill, and I think you mean those to be covered. I'm trying to understand what that means to have the word identifiable. It wasn't in the, I don't think it was in the court language. Is that correct?
Representative Clark, Mr. Gehring, can you tell us what the court had from 10 years ago?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, if you look at page 4 of the legislative plan comparison document that's been handed out, you can see the communities of interest that were identified in the 2000s process, and it specifically lists certain Indian reservations, Minneapolis neighborhoods, and St. Paul neighborhoods. Those are the communities of interest that were determined and sort of calculable in creating reports on preservation of communities of interest in 2001 and 2002.
Representative Clark?
Well,
So, Madam Chair, my question remains, what's the impact on other communities of interest? And, you know, I see that it has American Indian reservations, Minneapolis neighborhoods, St. Paul neighborhoods, but it doesn't have the...
Well, Representative Clark, how would you draw a boundary if you weren't able to identify the community?
Madam Chair, it may be a good word. I'm asking what the meaning of it is. What is the criteria for identifiable?
You would need to be able to identify the community of interest itself. And so if you were not able to identify that community, it would be impossible to have that recognized in a legislative or a congressional plan.
So, Madam Chair, what are the criteria, again, for identifying? What does that mean? That's my question.
Well, Representative Clark, if you look on page 2 of the amendment, and it goes in here, it says, including but not limited to racial, ethnic, geographic, social, or cultural interests.
So, Madam Chair, you mean it to be rather flexible, then, in this case, to be recognizable does not have a... the kind of numeric quantity, for example, when we're talking about the 1% or 2%, it's more something that the communities itself would recognize or identify rather than that it exists on a census document.
Representative Clark, you would have to be able to identify the community in order to draw a map that would recognize it.
Madam Chair, my question remains.
Representative Clark.
Remains, how do you identify it? That's my question. And that's why I'm asking that, what does that word mean? It may be an appropriate word, it may not be. I don't know what it means, and I'm trying to get that clear before we...
Sure. Well, Representative Clark, let's use neighborhoods as an example. If you go to the city of Minneapolis or St. Paul, you can get a map of the neighborhoods, and you see where those lines are drawn, but you don't, and that's what it means. It's identifiable.
Madam Chair.
Representative Clark.
Well, if you look at lines 2.21, there are not maps that show racial, ethnic, or geographic, social, or cultural groups in the same way, so that's why I'm asking.
Well, Representative Clark, when it comes to the racial issues, yes, we have that data as part of the Census Bureau data that was provided to us in March.
Right. Actually, I stand corrected, we do have racial, but we don't have the other categories that are listed there.
Well, Representative Clark, we do have the boundaries of the tribes, which would cover the ethnic portion of it.
Well, Madam Chair, ethnic is much bigger than tribal.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean... we have very diverse populations in our state, and some of them
are
concentrated, you know, in certain areas and feel an identity with each other and their communities of interest. And others, I would think, you know, maybe others are very dispersed, so it's not so clear. I'm just trying to understand what the criteria is here and what, because I didn't see that word before.
Representative Clark, are you suggesting that we remove that language? The racial, ethnic, geographic, social, or cultural interests?
Madam Chair, absolutely not. I'm talking about the word identifiable, as I have said about 3 or 4 times now, up on line 2.18.
Okay. Well, as I mentioned, you have to be able to identify the community of interest. So, members, any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Representative, we have a couple amendments. And, Madam Chair, can we exclude or hold over several subdivisions?
What do you mean, Representative Murphy, that you would amend to delete a subdivision of the amendment?
I think that Subdivision 3 and Subdivision 11... I would feel more comfortable if we had more time with them, and I don't. Subdivision 11 is establishing the priority, and
well, Representative Murphy,
I think I would like to think about the order of the subdivisions.
Mm-hmm. Well, Representative Murphy, We have, as you know, a committee rule that says that amendments need to be in place 24 hours in advance of the committee hearing. You do have amendments here that are on subdivision 3. So when we get to, after we have moved on this, we can go through your amendments. So if there's no further questions at this point, I'd like to move ahead and do the delete everything amendment and vote on that. So members, we are now voting on the DE1 amendment to House File 1547. All those in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
The amendment passes. Representative Murphy, you have some amendments that you would like to...
Representative Hartman.
Representative Hartman, you have some amendments. Which amendment would you like to proceed with first, Representative Hartman?
The A1.
Okay, members, we are looking at the A1 amendment to the House File 1547 DE1 amendment. Representative Hartman, can you please explain your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. What the A1 amendment would do is it would change the deviation standard in Subdivision 3 from being plus or minus 1% to being plus or minus 2%. And as we discussed as we went through the DE1 amendment, the 1% may not be flexible enough to allow whoever drafts the plan, us or the courts, to take a look at communities of interest to the greatest extent possible, or minor civil divisions, and to respect things like school district boundaries and township boundaries. And I think it would be the better part of prudence to have more flexibility in the standard that we adopt rather than less.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to speak against doing this. I'm just really, really concerned about the square miles. You know, you take a look at St. Louis County, they got 10,000 square miles up there already. I just think that with the governor's letter that he sent, trying to make that margin as narrow as possible, we did it in the past with the court-ordered district lines that were drawn in 2000, after the 2000 census, and come up with a deviation there of the 1.56. I think if they could do it then, we can certainly do it now. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fabian. All right, Representative Hartman renews her motion on the A1 amendment. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay.
No.
The amendment does not pass. Representative Hartman.
Madam Chair, I think we'll skip the A2 for now and go to the A3 amendment. The A3 amendment deals with...
Can you just give us a moment here, one sure. second, so we can track it down. Okay, Representative Hartman.
The A3 amendment deals with Subdivision 6, minority representation. And the phrasing that is in the DE1 amendment I find concerning, particularly in paragraph B. Paragraph A of the DE1 amendment talks about the constitutions of the laws of the United States of and Minnesota, which include our constitutions, and talks about the Voting Rights Act. But then in paragraph B, the way it's phrased, it says, a redistricting plan must not have the intent or effect of dispersing or concentrating minority population. And I'm concerned about the word concentrating in there because my understanding of the Voting Rights Act, limited though it is that what you try to do, if you can, is have majority-minority districts to provide an opportunity for minority representation in elected bodies. And what you also try to do is create minority opportunity districts so that if you can create a district where a minority has an opportunity to win, or you can create the district in such a way that the minority does not have the opportunity to win, that you seek to try to do that. And I think putting the word concentrating in at line 2.6 makes it more difficult to comply with the Voting Rights Act in providing minority opportunity districts. The language that is in the A3 amendment mirrors, I believe, what the court used in 2002 in their redistricting principles order that they set forth. And it also adds what I think is important language that says the districts must increase the probability that members of the minority will be elected. And I believe that's valuable language. I think we can all look around at the Minnesota House of Representatives and we can be very clear that it does not reflect the population of Minnesota the way it stands now with the information we have from the last census. And I think that it would be good for the state if the legislature looked more like the state of Minnesota looks.
Members, any questions on the A3 amendment?
If I could just ask Mr. Gehring whether my amendment should delete the whole subdivision or just B.
Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, Representative Hortman, I think you could do it either way. It sounds from the comments that you made that you're concerned mostly about paragraph B, and so you could take the text of your amendment and just make it a new paragraph B and keep paragraph A intact if that's what you'd like to do. The way the amendment is drafted, it would take out the whole subdivision.
Representative Hortman.
I'd like to incorporate that change into my amendment where it simply applies to line 1.3 instead of saying delete subdivision 6, it should say delete subdivision 6B.
Members, did you all get that?
And Madam Chair, I'd like a roll call.
Representative Hortman asked for a roll call on the A3 amendment. So you are, just to clarify, so you're going to be keeping lines 2.1 through 2.4, but you're removing lines 2.5 through 2.7 with your amendment. Is that correct, Representative Hortman?
That's correct.
Mr. Gehring?
Madam Chair, and just to be clear for the record, we'll take out the reference to subdivision 6, minority representation, and make that a paragraph B on line 1.4 of the amendment.
Okay, so this amendment, A3, becomes paragraph A.
Paragraph B. The amendment would become paragraph B.
Okay. You know what, I'm not sure I'm clear on this. Mr. Gehring, can you walk through what we have here? What part of the delete everything amendment are we keeping? What part are we removing?
So
if you can go by line, please.
So on the DE1 amendment, what would be happening is you'd be deleting lines 2.5 to 2.7, and then you'd be inserting the text of Representative Hortman's amendment as paragraph B.
Okay. Well, Representative Hortman, I have to speak against your amendment. I think that as we have it, we have very strong language in place to protect minority population and making sure that they have the opportunity to elect candidates of their choice. So I recommend members to vote no. Ms. Hensing, if you can proceed with
Representative Anderson.
Representative Hortman.
Could we ask if there's anybody in the audience that would like to testify for or against the amendment?
Sure. Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to testify for or against the A3 amendment? Please step forward, and you need to state your name for the record.
I'm Sally Finding.
Before you, but you need to do it at the microphone, because otherwise we can't hear it on the tape. These microphones don't pick up that well.
I'm Sally Finding. I'm a member of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. I've testified once before, and I'm here today because I'm still not hearing that the American Indian community is, what I'm hearing is that we're being included with minority communities in Minnesota, when the fact is that we really aren't a minority community. We're a politically bound by treaty community. We're sovereign nations. Now, when you put us in the same category as minorities, there is not going to be any way that I can see where redistricting is going to affect the possibility that we might someday have representation at the state table. So I think that we should always, when we're talking about the Indian communities in Minnesota, we should always make sure that we recognize that we have a sovereign nation. We're not minorities. We're a sovereign nation. So I would like to say that, you know, as far as this goes, I see that it's definitely trying to be inclusive, but it's not going to make a difference for us as American Indians in the state of Minnesota. So I'd like to see that language really be more effective. You know, when we look at the legislature, we haven't had representation, and we are always being negatively impacted by decisions that are made because we don't have representation. So I would like to see that section be specific, more specific to American Indians.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Linde. Representative Clark.
Wait, before the witness leaves, I want to ask her a question.
Ms. Linde, could you stay at the testifier table, please? Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm very familiar with what you're talking about, and I recognize that the word minority is a census language. It comes from the census, and I'm just wondering if you would be more comfortable, and maybe this is something we can talk about as a potential amendment. I know in my own district, when I address my American Indian colleagues, I always use the word either Indigenous American Indian or Native American Indian, and I'm just wondering if, Madam Chair, if, well, first of all, I'll ask Ms. Finde, if the language said minority and Indigenous American Indian representation, would you be more comfortable with that?
I would.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I know that, you know, we have our amendments done and so on, but I think the point that's being raised is really a really important one, and we all overlooked it, and I'm just wondering if we could consider that as a friendly amendment, either to your amendment or, Madam Chair, as a separate amendment to the bill.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that, Representative Clark. We also have the section dealing with communities of interest, which I hopefully addresses Ms. Finde's concerns. Love to have a conversation with you to talk about that some more, though, too. Representative Hortman.
Let me ask Mr. Gehring if he knows, in the verbiage of the Voting Rights Act, whether minority is specifically defined and does it include American Indians?
Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, Representative Hortman, I believe minority is defined. It also includes the language minorities, and I believe it does include American Indian cultures.
Okay, Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I hear what Representative Clark and what the witness are saying. I just, because we're here and pretty short notice with our amendments, and we just had a few hours to adjust them to the DE1 amendment, I don't want to do something that creates a problem with the Voting Rights Act, because what I'm trying to do is provide more rights under the Voting Rights Act. So I, you know, I guess I don't have a problem with including the language. I can't see how that could hurt. But if we do find out that there's a problem, maybe then we could fix that on the floor. Okay. If my amendment is successful.
All right.
So, Representative Clark, were you offering a friendly amendment on line 1.5 after the word minority or American Indian or Indigenous American Indian?
Actually, I was adding and Indigenous American Indian because, Madam Chair, if I may respond, that under the communities of interest, ethnic doesn't really do it. I think that was what you mentioned earlier. It's not the same thing. This is a sovereign nation designation, and I guess I think, again, if we could prevent ourselves from overlooking it, I'd like to do that. So if that's a friendly amendment, if not, maybe I could offer it separately either way.
Well, Representative Clark, again, we have a 24-hour rule when it comes to amendments, so this did not meet the 24-hour rule. Also, when you're looking at the subdivision 8 and we're talking about preserving communities of interest, it includes everything and not limited to racial, ethnic, geographic, social, and cultural interests. So with that, Representative Hortman, do you renew your motion on A3 amendment?
Representative Anderson, I would be happy to incorporate a friendly oral amendment if that would be appropriate. I also think there's another individual who wanted to testify with regard to the language of the amendment.
Let's hear the other individual that would like to come forward to testify on this.
Third point would be that the issue of including or not including American Indians would be appropriate in this section because it deals with the Voting Rights Act and their rights are covered in the Voting Rights Act, mm-hmm. and that's a stronger protection than the issue of communities of interest.
Okay. Mr. Garcia. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. I'm Hector Garcia, Executive Director of the Chicano Latino Affairs Council, and I would support the amendment on the basis that the wording in the amendment is more conducive to bringing about a positive result. Must increase the probability that members of the minority will be selected, in contrast to the current language, which is, I think, would leave open the possibility of not promoting this to take place. Rather, it's just, you know, avoiding the prevention of minority communities from being from electing their candidates of choice. So that would be my recommendation. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Garcia? All right. Representative Hortman, your motion on the A3 amendment?
Madam Chair, did you were you going to allow the oral amendment or no?
No.
All right, then I guess I renew my motion on the A3 as amended.
Okay. Members, all those in favor of the A3 amendment?
Roll call.
She did? Okay. Okay. We've got a roll call on this amendment. Ms. Hensing?
Okay. Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Fabian?
No.
Representative Clark?
Yes.
Representative Dowd?
No.
Representative Garofalo?
No.
Representative Hoppe?
Yes.
Hoppe.
That's why I'm coming up fast on the other side.
Sorry. Representative Hortman?
Yes.
Representative Loon?
No.
Representative Marquardt?
Yes.
Representative Murphy?
Yes.
Representative Poppy?
No, it's Poppy, right?
Yes.
Okay, yes.
Representative Scott?
No.
Okay, the amendment did not pass. Representative Hortman, your next amendment?
Let's get the A4 amendment. This deals with divisions of political subdivisions, and again, it's an issue of phrasing. What my amendment would do would, on page 2, after line 10, it would add a sentence, when a county, city, or town must be divided into more than one district, it should be divided into as few districts as possible. And this is language that I believe also was in the court order and was not in the language in your DE1 amendment.
Okay, members, any questions?
Madam Chair. Representative Clark, I have a question, and I haven't talked with the author of the amendment about it, but I think the issue of whether or not neighborhoods are considered in our listing of either community of interest and so on, can you clarify that for me? I know you mentioned earlier that you thought it somehow was included. Can you tell me where? Because maybe, again, this might be a place where we would want to look at.
Representative Hortman.
I'm sorry, that was a question for me.
You can, Madam Chair, you could start, and then I actually was asking the chair, but...
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Clark. I have to tell you, I have trouble hearing you. If you could, that would be helpful. Thank you. What I have concerns with this amendment is it doesn't allow for communities of interest, and I know that is an issue area of concern for you. Representative Clark.
Madam Chair, I don't think this deletes the community of interest in any way, right? No, so I'm not. I don't see it that way. My question was a different one. It was a question about neighborhoods. Is there, and I guess I'm just trying to understand whether or not we consider neighborhoods anywhere in here. And I see this amendment doesn't specify it, but I thought I heard you say earlier that we did, that there was a place in here. And maybe it's on the not limited to language. Is that right?
Representative Clark, in the subdivision 8, yes, that's where you would find it.
Okay. Thank you. So I I guess I would just say this seems like a good amendment. I wouldn't see it as in any way threatening communities of interest. Representative Hortman?
I guess I'd renew my motion on A4.
Okay. Members, all those in favor of the A4 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
No. The amendment does not pass. Representative Hortman.
I forgot to vote. The next amendment I have is A5.
Okay.
And this pertains to communities of interest. And again, the language in my amendment mirrors the court order from 2002. And there's one additional factor. I want to make sure that, they're all in there. What your DE1 has are five different descriptive terms for communities of interest: racial, ethnic, geographic, social, cultural. What it omits, but what was in the court order, is economic. And so what my amendment would do is it would mirror the court order by adding the word economic. It's okay. Also phrased a little bit more tightly to match what was in the court order.
Okay.
And it says including but not limited to. So what it does is it allows this group, should we take testimony from individuals that enlighten us to something we don't know about right now, or a court, if they're drawing the lines, to consider things that aren't in the list but would fairly be considered communities of interest.
Okay. Representative Hortman, I think Representative Doubt, did you have a question on this?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hortman, you've got the very last sentence of your amendment, or I guess line 1.9, that are linked by common transportation. What exactly do you mean by that?
Representative Hortman.
One example would be in the area that I currently represent, the Mississippi River. We have two bridges over the Mississippi River, and we have a dam, the Coon Rapids Dam. And it links people who live in different counties and different cities, because what rules and regulations are imposed in the Mississippi River or what happens to the Coon Rapids Dam equally affects the east and west sides of the river. And so they're a community of interest because of that common transportation and because that common geographic area, even though you might not notice that if you didn't live there.
Representative Doubt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hortman. Today the FTA approved $460 million for the funding of this Central Corridor Rail project. Is that an example of the kind of transportation that you're talking about?
Representative Hortman.
You know, Representative Doubt, the way that the communities of interest factor has been looked at before is there's not any one determinative factor. And so I don't think, for example, the fact that people are linked by a commuter rail line or a light rail line on its own would make a community of interest, but it may. I mean, if we were to take more testimony and we were to find out there was some significant compelling thing that united those people, then this more broad language that I have would allow us to take that into account.
Representative Down.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I had a question for Representative Hortman also on that same line, but more on the communication area. And kind of, can you provide any explanation on what that would encompass, a common communication form?
Representative Hortman.
Well, I know in one specific example, and I don't know if this gets quite at what you're talking about, Representative Ryan Winkler represents a very tight-knit religious subgroup that their movements are confined to a certain area that on a certain day of the week, and it is defined in a certain way. It would make sense to keep that community of interest together because they're bound. And I don't know if communication is exactly getting at that, but it also could address the issue of language and local media.
Representative Loon.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hartman. I guess I'm just, you know, since the last time we went through this process 10 years ago, communication methods have, you know, continued to change a lot. I mean, I don't know how many people
continue to get their news from, say, a local newspaper or that. My guess is a lot of people get it from the internet and other methods, so it's changed greatly over the past 10 years, and so I'm just wondering how we would determine sort of a common communication system and apply that to the standard now for communities of interest, just given the technological changes and the different ways in which people receive their news about what's going on in their community, in their state. So,
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, if it will get me enough votes to get my amendment on, I could always change that language. What the court had as the last clause of their language was that additional communities of interest will be considered if persuasively established and not in violation of applicable law. If people are more comfortable with that language than the phrase or that are linked by common transportation and communication. If it doesn't get me more... It doesn't change the eventual outcome. I'm not sure it's necessary to go through the exercise.
Representative Lynn, any further comments?
No, thank you.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just looking at the language of this amendment, and this did meet the 24-hour rule, and so is in. And I'm just looking at line 1.8 where it says the word political is there, which, again, is missing in your bill. And it seems to me that might meet the criteria of our American Indian sovereign nations who are politically recognized subdivisions of the federal government. And so it would be another reason, a very strong reason, I think, for making sure we're not leaving them out, and at least it's not an ethnic group, it's not an ethnic group, but it certainly is political subdivision. So, Madam Chair, that would be another reason why I would think this might be good. I don't think it does any damage to the language that you have in your bill. The other thing is, I recall, I think the last time in terms of common transportation, I think the courts found that I-35W corridor was a community of interest. I think Mr. Guerin can tell us that, but I was surprised at that too, but that is the kind of thing where they take a transportation corridor and say that these folks have a common interest and should be considered insofar as it's possible.
Mr. Guerin?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, in establishing congressional districts in the 2002 process, the courts did find that the I-90 corridor south of the state constituted a community of interest, as well as the I-94 corridor up to St. Cloud.
Thank you. So, Madam Chair?
Representative Clark.
Can I just ask you again, what is your take on including the word political, understanding that it would allow us then to include American Indian sovereign nations as political subdivisions?
Well, actually, Representative Clark, the American Indian population is included in this. They are protected under the Voting Rights Act. We also have in our communities of interest where we're talking about cultural interests as well. So they are already covered. And I'm just curious, I think this is a question for Representative Horbin. What exactly did you mean by political? If you can give us a definition of what that means to you.
Madam Chair, Representatives, what I was doing was mirroring the language in the court principles that they used in 2002. So that is where the word political comes from.
And Representative Hortman, what do you mean by political then?
Well, interestingly enough, the court in 2002 didn't say that they were looking at competitiveness. That's sort of a different issue I have later on. But then they did put together a bunch of competitiveness charts. But I don't know what the court meant by the word political or why they included it, but they did. And I thought that the we should mirror what had been done in Minnesota's history.
Okay. Members, any other questions? Seeing none, did you? Okay. We're going to be voting on the A5 amendment. All those in favor of the A5 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? No.
No.
Amendment does not pass. Representative Hortman.
This one should be the most interesting conversation, maybe. I'm hoping people have more to say about this one than the others. And this is a factor, the A6 amendment would introduce a factor that has not been considered in the past, but Arizona found it so important and compelling that they amended their constitution to include it. And it would include political competitiveness. Now, I know that out of the 134 seats in the House of Representatives, there's only a few of us who represent districts that could go either way in a given election. And I know that also we hear from the public a lot, what they would really like is they would really like a legislature that can find the middle. And the problem is when we have districts that are not competitive there's no incentive for a representative to go to the middle. If you come from a hardcore Republican district, your biggest threat to re-election is a primary challenge or an endorsing challenge. If you live in a hardcore DFL district, your biggest threat is another DFLer who could be to the left of you. And part of that is about how we draw the lines. And I think it's a value to the state to have more people who represent communities that are more half and half, because then the community rewards pragmatic problem solving more than party loyalty. And so this would introduce the concept of political competitiveness as a positive asset to be considered in our redistricting plan.
Okay, and I believe, Mr. Dean, you wanted to come and speak to this amendment. If you could please state your name for the record and the organization.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mike Dean. I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Minnesota. I did want to speak in support of the amendment. I think that this is a really important criteria that you're addressing. But first, I just wanted to thank you for taking the time today to discuss the principles. I think this is a really important part of the process and really important first step. Regarding competition as a principle, we've sort of seen a growing polarization in this country over really the last couple decades. And a lot of people feel that this is brought on because of the redistricting process, because too often lines are drawn in a way where safe districts are created for one party or the other. California, unfortunately, has been the poster child for this. And I think it really decreases the lack of confidence in our government right now, because people feel that no matter who they vote for, that the outcome doesn't really change at all, because so many of these districts are created in a way where the outcome is already sort of predetermined. And so I think incorporating competition in the criteria really sort of solidifies this as an important principle that you adopt, because really competition is at the heart of our democracy. The idea that you have two parties sort of debating ideas, discussing those ideas, have equal opportunity before the voters. And without that competition, voters really are not given much of an opportunity at the election system. And so I think that it's really important that you incorporate this in. Also, this helps ensure accountability with yourself, basically, as legislators. And having that accountability is key to this process in a democracy. So I would really encourage you to incorporate this criteria going in. This has been discussed in years past, part of the Ventura Commission, which was a bipartisan group that really looked at the redistricting process, made competition a really key element of it, and I think brought about some interesting ideas on how to make the process better, but also improve the type of districts that are created in the end. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Dean. Any questions for Mr. Dean? All right. Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Dean. Any questions on the amendment, the A6 amendment, members? Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to my my friend, the author of the amendment. We had this discussion earlier in this session, but regarding political competitiveness, and I brought up the example of a precinct in my district and did a little bit of further research and found out there's a lot of precincts in Minnesota like this, where if you take a look at the five elections that have taken place between 02 and 010, 02, 04, 06, 08, 010, you'll see wild deviations in vote totals and same candidates being on the ballot. And even in your district, in fact, Representative Hartman, there's some precincts where you have had dramatically different swings in individual precincts. And I'm wondering, for the members of the committee, how would we guide a competitiveness in those precincts? How would one calculate that, when the same candidate in the same geographic boundaries in different elections has wild deviations in their election returns?
Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, the court came up with a measure, and I wish I could tell you that I knew what it was, but I believe that it was top-of-the-ticket races through the preceding decade. And I know that there's some races that are better proxy for your core vote. For example, a lower-profile constitutional officer race where nobody's really heard of either one, and that's more of a proxy for party identification than for the winning candidate. But perhaps Mr. Gehring knows what the index was used by the court.
Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, Representative Portman, in the 2000s process, there was an index created for determining political competitiveness, and it looked at the votes for minor constitutional offices. within the preceding two election cycles, I believe.
And Representative Hartman. I won't tell them that we call them minor constitutional officers.
Well,
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as I voiced earlier, my concern about this earlier in the year, is even when you take a look at those, using Representative Hartman's term, minor constitutional offices, if you take a look at the, for example, Secretary of State, State Auditor, which I'm assuming we're referring to as minor, if you look at identical political jurisdictions, even with identical candidates on the ballot, in fact, the State Auditor's race were exactly the same candidates in 06 and 010, you will see very wide discrepancies in terms of election returns. And so attributing that to a static voter model in a voter district is just it is not accurate. There's many other characteristics, people's opinions, people's trends, people's voting behavior is not a static model that is stationary in the future. And an additional concern I would have is that in determining this political competitiveness model, would there be a weighting? Would you apply a different weight to an election of, say, 2010 than 2006? Earlier, Representative Hartman brought up the fact that growing communities change and there's different patterns. So the voting behaviors of a district could either be attributed to, identical candidates. Voting behaviors could change because of a difference in opinion, but also the people who are living in that district can change. So if we're using 06 data to determine political competitiveness of a precinct or a jurisdiction, that could just be historically inaccurate data. And so, Madam Chair, members, I would oppose this amendment.
Members, we're just going to briefly recess here for about 15 minutes. So if you can come back at 3:05. But first, we're going to take the vote here quickly. Any other comments, Representative Hartman?
Madam Chair, I don't think I asked for a roll.
Okay. And is that what you want?
Sure.
Okay.
The voice vote. I think I know how it ends up.
All right. Ms. Hensing.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Fabian?
No.
Representative Clark?
Yes.
Representative Dowd?
No.
Representative Garofalo?
No.
Representative Hoppe is absent. Representative Portman?
Aye.
Representative Loon?
No.
Representative Marquardt? Gone. Representative Murphy?
No.
Representative Poppy?
Yes.
Representative Scott?
No.
Captain. The amendment did not pass, and members, we will return to more amendments at, let's make it 3:10. We are in recess. Officially reconvening the redistricting committee. Representative Hartman, you have the A7 amendment.
That's right, Madam Chair. The A7 amendment deals with the issue of incumbents, and it's not in the issue of incumbents is not covered in the DE1 amendment. I think one of the reasons that the public distrusts this process is they believe that we take a look at a map, that we look at where we live and where our friends live, and then we try to make sure that we're not creating a district where any of our friends or us would lose our jobs. And I think it's very important, though we are not the ones who broke the trust with the public, that we as public servants do whatever we can to restore the trust with the public. And I think adopting a specific provision that says districts should not be drawn for the purpose of protecting or defeating incumbents would be a helpful signal to the public that we take this very seriously and that our job is to draw fair districts, letting the chips fall where they may with regard to incumbents.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Hartman. On this issue, you know, when I look at this issue, when we put together the principles overall, you know, our focus was on equal representation, making sure that minorities have the opportunity for representation, keeping our counties and cities and our townships whole, and as well as addressing communities of interest. And, you know, when I look at this, I think that this says just the opposite of what your intent is. I see that it's placing an emphasis on incumbents, and I think that's the last thing that we want to do and the last message that we want to send to the citizens of Minnesota. So I would ask members to vote no on this amendment. Members, any other questions or thoughts on the A7 amendment? If not, do we have a roll call on this one? Okay. All those in...
Madam Chair, I think Representative Murphy was going to say something.
Representative Murphy?
Madam Chair, if we don't say anything about incumbents, then they're left to draw their own opinion.
Yeah.
that the people are left to do what Representative Hortman said, just conclude that if we're not addressing incumbents, if we're not saying we're not, these districts are being drawn not to protect nor to defeat an incumbent. I like the idea of putting the word incumbent in there and having this definition.
Well, let me ask Representative Hortman this. Did the courts have an incumbent clause anywhere? Can you tell me that?
Madam Chair, yes, the court did.
Excuse me?
Yes, Madam Chair, the court did in the principles that they drafted. If you give me just a second, I can get to my court order. They did mention something about incumbents, and they phrased it a little bit differently.
Mr. Gearing, could you help us out on that, please?
Madam Chair, Representative Portman, the court did include a clause related to incumbency in its principles, and their clause reads as follows. Districts may not be drawn for the purpose of protecting or defeating an incumbent. However, as a factor subordinate to all redistricting criteria, the panel may view a proposed plan's effect on incumbents to determine whether the plan results in either undue incumbent protection or excessive incumbent conflicts.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gearing. Representative Hoppe, you had a question?
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. I just had a comment on this, and I think when you look at some other states, particularly at other states' congressional districts and how they are drawn and gerrymandered and they do this, I think that's what causes the public angst and earns distrust. I think if you look at the districts in Minnesota, are both our congressional and legislative Senate and House districts, I don't think we see that. We might run into some instances where we pit two incumbents together where it just works out that way, but I don't think we're drawing districts specifically to, you know, go after an incumbent or to protect an incumbent, and I don't think we've done that historically. I mean, if you look at what our districts are now and what they were 10 years ago, I don't think that's the case here.
Representative Hortman.
Madam Chair, I would like a roll call on this, and I have an alternate phrasing for my next amendment, also on the issue of incumbents.
All right, Ms. Hansing is going to take the roll.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Fabian?
No.
Representative Clark?
Yes.
Representative Doubt?
No.
Representative Garofalo?
No.
Representative Hoppe?
No.
Representative Hortman?
Yes.
Representative Loon?
No.
Representative Marquardt?
Yes.
Representative Murphy?
Yes.
Representative Hoppe?
Yes.
And Representative Scott. So do not hurt them.
The amendment does not pass. We are on to the next amendment. Representative Hortman.
Yep. Madam Chair, I think I lost my A9 amendment. So for the moment, I'm going to move on to A10 because it also pertains to incumbents. And it's an alternate phrasing, and I wonder if people are more comfortable with this one because it exactly parallels the court language. The language in the A10 amendment says that a district must not be drawn for the purpose of protecting or defeating an incumbent, and then it has that additional sentence that Matt Gearing just read about viewing a plan to determine its effect on all incumbents. And the reason why I thought that this language is something we might want to discuss is that there was some concern by some women who were in the legislature in 2002 that some of the plans, the draft plans that were put forward with either a deliberate or an inadvertent effect of reducing the number of women serving in the legislature. And so what the second sentence in this incumbent phrasing does would allow a court or this legislature to look at whether, for example, we were inadvertently pairing people that we in population groups that we actually want to retain in the legislature, whether that be minority or gender-based.
Well, Representative Hortman, can you tell me where we would get the gender data to do this?
Representative Anderson, the way that the court looked at it is they looked at the matchups that would be created and what percentage of the legislature was women and what percentage of the matchups were women versus women as opposed to men versus men.
Okay. Well, Representative Hortman, so what in your term, you use the term excessive. Can you tell me what that means? What is your definition of excessive?
Madam Chair, I think that that would be something that would be in the eye of the beholder, but I think if we, for example, had a draft map that got put forward that made it more difficult for our currently serving minority members to continue serving, or if we had a map that made it very difficult for a reasonable proportion of women to continue to serve in the legislature, that would be probably excessive.
Well, Representative Hortman, I can imagine that you know you understand how difficult it would be to try and achieve a goal where it's people are viewing it in the eye of the beholder. We have 201 lawmakers plus a governor, and we're going to say that we're going to leave it up to the eye of the beholder on what constitutes excessive incumbent conflicts. I think that is very problematic. And with that, I would encourage members to vote no. Members, any other questions? Representative Hortman?
Madam Chair, actually, I mean, I think saying it the way that you've said it kind of makes light of what the court actually did in 2002 in looking at the percentages. And I think that looking at the percentages is clear when you compare. There were 28% of paired senators and 24% of paired representatives, and that matched pretty well with 20% of the senators being female and 24% of representatives being paired. Now, I suppose we could put forth a specific percentage deviation, but I think, you know, reasonable people can be reasonable about what constitutes excessive, and excessive would mean something that looks like you're going after one gender or another.
Well, I'm not going to belabor the point. You know, I think that when you're talking about having people define what excessive is and that it's the eye of the beholder, that that's problematic. Members, any other comments on this amendment?
Madam Chair.
Representative Clark.
Well, both this amendment and the previous one, I think the principle I hear you invoking is that silence is better than being affirmative about the issue, and it just seems to me like that I thought what Representative Hortman laid out as an effort to try to, you know, have the trust of the public and, you know, the trust of the electorate is really important. So I don't think this eye of the beholder thing is a very correct way to talk about it. It seems to me, you know, there are numbers of people who are minorities. There are identifiable, working in districts or communities, and it seems to me that we have had a real problem with this. I guess you're probably running off with them, but we had a real problem in one of our recent elections where there were, you know, it was a really disproportionate pitting of women against each other. And it was not okay. And I think talking about it is a virtue rather than something to make light of. And so I guess I think it's a really good amendment, and I guess I would urge support.
Well, thank you, Representative Clark. But I think when we're putting in this kind of language, I think we're sending the wrong message to the public. I think that when we're adopting our principles, our focus should not be on incumbents and our own fellow lawmakers. Our focus should be on equal representation, on minority representation, on maintaining communities and communities of interest. And that's why we don't put this language in there. So that's just my thoughts on it. Any other comments, members? All right, we're going to take a vote on the A-10. Is there a roll call on this one? All those in favor of the A-10 amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? No.
No.
Amendment does not pass. Representative Hortman.
Well, I found the A-9 amendment.
Okay.
The A-9 amendment deals with public review and comment, and I think it's no secret to any of the members of the committee that I'm not crazy about the amount of public review and comment opportunities we've had so far, and I think we can do more and we can do better going forward, and I think we should adopt an amendment that puts this in the principles, that says in law that this is an important factor. The redistricting plan lasts for 10 years. A lot of the laws that we pass, they can be changed. You can come back the next year and a different legislature can repeal it. But this is something that has at least a 10-year duration and has an impact on people's representation. And so I think it's critically important in our democratic system that the public actually has a meaningful opportunity to participate. And A9 gets at that. And what it states is that we would intend that a redistricting plan should not be implemented unless members of the public have been given a reasonable opportunity to provide comment to the committee or panel developing the plan, and that public comment should be received in an open forum and in a manner that respects the diverse regions and communities of the state. And I, you know, would respectfully disagree with the chair that the level of outreach that we've had in suburban and urban communities and towards minority communities is in a manner that respects these diverse regions and communities. I think that we could go to more places. We still have time to travel to more places. And all we have to do is look at the three field hearings that we did have and how valuable it was to actually be in Hermantown and how valuable it was to actually be in Marshall and to be in Rochester and listen to what people said because they were able to come and speak to us. And so I would offer the A9.
Members, any questions or comments on the A9 amendment? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hortman, what's your definition of reasonable?
Representative Hortman.
1.6.
I think that a reasonable opportunity is a location that's accessible to some proportion of the population living in that area. I think there are a lot of people who find it prohibitively difficult to get to the Capitol. I mean, you do a very nice job of coming from a very far place, but there are people who, because of their mobility impairments or because of their income level or because of their knowledge and information of what's going on at the state capitol versus their knowledge and information of what's happening in their community, coming to the Capitol is very difficult. And so I think a reasonable opportunity is one that a normal person would avail themselves of.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hortman, I think it's incumbent upon us, too, though, as legislators, to make sure that people know that the process is in place and that we get a message out via our emails or our town halls that we're having, phone calls back to school board members, mayors, county commissioners. For them, if you have concerns about redistricting, make sure that you send a note to Chair Anderson and or myself, and I'll bring those forward for you. So I compliment our committee. I think we did really a good job. Coming in here as somebody new, having no idea what any of this stuff is, let alone the redistricting process, I'm impressed with the openness and the transparency and the availability that we've had, realizing that rural Minnesota is at a disadvantage to a certain degree simply because of our location. But my sense is, representing the people that I do, if they have extremely strong feelings about an issue with regards to redistricting, it's quite possible that they would have been here, as is evidenced by this morning in the Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Committee. The mayor from Rosa was down, our environmental officer, and traveled, you know, at great length to come down to testify for about 10 minutes. And that shows a level of commitment. So that's just my comment. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think if I understand this amendment correctly, it's actually about when the plan comes forward, then giving people the amount of time to be able to comment on what a plan would be, if I'm understanding it correctly, which is different from, you know, there can be some disagreement about, you know, what's been happening since January and how we've included people and how we've been encouraging people to make comments and suggestions and think through what the process and what the plan might be. But once we actually have the plan, I think, if I understand it correctly, that's when there would be a reasonable opportunity for people to then say, this is something that we, now when we see it in black and white, and we have a feeling that this is a good idea or a bad idea, or this, you know, this takes away a community that I, you know, that I have that's very directly, you know, connected to another city within my district or whatever, that either representatives, senators, and or the community members would have maybe a view that when they see it in black and white, they'd have the opportunity then to be able to speak about it. That's if I understand correctly. So maybe I just want a clarification from Representative Hortman.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I'd like to request a roll call. And second, I'd like to say the way the amendment is drafted, it applies to the entire period before development of the plan and after the plan. And the A12 amendment gets to the time period after a draft plan has been put out.
Okay. We've got a roll call on the A9 amendment. Ms. Hensing?
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Fabian?
No.
Representative Clark?
Yes.
Representative Dowd?
No.
Representative Garofalo?
No.
Representative Hoppe?
No.
Representative Portman?
Yes.
Representative Loon?
No.
Representative Marquardt?
Yes.
Representative Murphy?
Yes.
Representative Hoppe?
Yes.
Representative Scott? No. Oh.
It failed. The amendment does not pass. Representative Portman?
The H-12 amendment also gets to the issue of public involvement and transparency and openness, and this is the one that gets to the issue that Representative Hoppe just raised about how critically important it is for the public to weigh in once there is a draft plan or a preliminary plan. And what the H-12 amendment would require would be that there's at least 3 hearings to take public comment after the release of the preliminary plan by the legislative committees responsible for redistricting. And I would also like a roll call on this.
Well, thank you, Representative Portman. You know, as I've said many times, we have had 13 hearings to date spanning 4 months. We did 3 of them out in Greater Minnesota. We have invited testifier after testifier to come forward and give us comment on the redistricting process overall. And the idea behind it is, you know, when you sit down and have your meal, you don't put the food on the table first. You put down the plates, the cups, the silverware, and then you put the food down on the table. And that's what we're doing here today with this whole process. We're setting the table first, then we can, you know, have the dinner that we have with it. It's just we have sought the input of these folks so that when we are putting together plans, we know what their thoughts are, and we've done extensive outreach to do that. So, members, I would oppose this amendment, and I do. We have a roll call on this one as well. All right. Any other comments, members? Seeing none, we'll take the roll. Ms. Hensing.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Fabian?
No.
Representative Clark?
Yes.
Representative Doubt?
No.
Representative Garofalo?
No.
Representative Hoppe?
No.
Representative Portman?
Yes.
Representative Loon?
No.
Representative Marquardt?
Yes.
Representative Murphy?
Yes.
Representative Hoppe?
Yes.
And Representative Scott's gone.
The amendment does not prevail. Representative Portman.
My final amendment, the A13, maybe it'll be my lucky amendment because it's so common sense, everybody will want to vote for it. This amendment gets, again, at the issue of transparency and accessibility for the public to provide a meaningful opportunity to contribute, not just an opportunity to contribute, but a meaningful opportunity to contribute. And what the A13 amendment provides is that a redistricting plan won't be voted on by a House or Senate committee until it's been posted and available to the public for at least 1 week. And I think that it's really important to give people the time to digest a proposed map, to talk to people in their community, to get together with like-minded people, to figure out how they weigh in, to find out the map is out there, that we not take action on something until we give the public a week's notice. And I would like a roll call on this amendment.
Well, Representative Portman, you know, this is no different than any other committee, any other bill that we have at the legislature. And to have it at a 1 week higher threshold than what we do for health and human services, K-12 education, the tax bill, to me is not helpful to this overall process. I recall you voting for a bill that had blank appropriations that we were voting on. So I just think it's ironic that you're offering this today, and I encourage members to vote no. Any other comments, members? Representative Hoppe.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I think I just want to make a comment about the public. Certainly, as we heard this bill today and the principles, and thinking about the principles and thinking about having the opportunity for people to weigh in, I think, you know, one of the issues that I think was a bit concerning was, you know, we devote, let me rephrase that. We depend a great deal on our staff. Mr. Gehring has been doing a tremendous job, and certainly partisan staff does a good job, but our nonpartisan research staff, you know, we're dependent upon them to help us to really set the table, if you will, and do it with all of the utensils, all of the plates, all of the, you know, all of the napkins, all of the glasses, everything that we want. We want to be able to do that in the most fair, open, transparent way so that the public does have the opportunity to look at, you know, what's missing on the table? What else should we be thinking about and talking about? And so I guess, you know, maybe the length of time is excessive from your perspective. Maybe it seems like it's too much. But I think one of the things that we really want to make sure is this is something that's going to be in place for 10 years. And it isn't a time to kind of shut down and say, okay, we don't want to hear from people and to know kind of what their reaction is. It's our opportunity to say, here is the table. You know, what do you think? Is this have we covered everything? Would we like to see more or less? It's the public's responsibility to some degree to come forward and say this is what we like or this is what we don't like. It's certainly our responsibility to carry the message as much as we can to encourage people to participate in the process. But I don't think it's unreasonable to expect to have a length of time that allows people to be able to say, you know what, let's really consider what this is, what the meaning is, how it's going to be in the future for all of us. So I don't think it's unreasonable, and I do support this amendment.
Well, Representative Poppy, that's what we've been doing the last 4 months, is getting the input from the public. And inviting them to come here and to email and to write letters and everything. That this has been a 4-month-long process and getting people's input. So I think that we have done that, and I would restate my opposition to the amendment. Representative Clark.
Oh, Madam Chair, did you? I thought
just one Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not bringing this forward to make anyone feel defensive about what the process has been. I there was somebody else that talked about at the beginning how, you know, what this was and how long this was. This is a trying session for many people. This is a trying committee in some ways. It certainly takes a lot of your time, I'm sure. I'm just trying to offer it up as, this is bigger than us. This is bigger than our committee. This really is something that it's important for all of us to have good public input. And as you've stated, you feel confident in the amount of public input we've had up to date. I'm just talking about once the plan is out there, you know that people are going to have a reaction to that. And how can we allow them to have a period of time to be able to have that reaction and be able to then continue to move forward from that point. Thank you.
Well, and Representative Poppy, I appreciate that. I guess from my perspective, this is, when I look at the Health and Human Services Bill and the K-12 Bill, the Environment Finance Bill, to me, those are all equally important to this. And I don't buy into the argument that, those are going to be have any less impact over a 10-year period than what this legislation will have. Everything that we do at the legislature has long-term impact and is important, and I would hope that when every member is looking at these different pieces of legislation, that they have that in their hearts and are mindful of that when they're voting on these provisions and are getting the input of their citizens. And that's what I'm saying is this bill is no different than any other piece of legislation that we have here at the Capitol. So are we to say then that we should have a 1-week review period for all of those other bills, which flies in the face of Capitol tradition here for as long as I've been here, and I'm sure as long as Representative Murphy has been here. So I would guess that's what I'm saying is this: we should not be treating this to a different threshold than what we treat any other issue that is covered at the Capitol. Representative Poppy.
Thank you.
Representative Clark.
Madam Chair, actually, I think your last comment really is not correct. This is unique. The redistricting plan only happens once every 10 years. It's very unique. It's not the same as, laws that we can change every 2 years or even every year. I don't think we have anything to be afraid of. I'm not sure what you're afraid of. I don't think we should have anything to be afraid of by asking for public input after we're using this analogy, we're setting the table. We've actually put the food out there now. Let's see if people like it. How does it taste? Or is there something wrong? I mean, I think that's very different than just setting the table. It's actually serving the meal and seeing what the response is. So I guess I think it's
I think it's really a smart idea, and it will actually go towards healing, I think, some of the issues that have been dividing us, I hope. So I think it's a good amendment.
Madam Chair.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Just a little bit on the process. When a plan or a map gets brought forward, is there any amending of that map? Like, let's say it comes before this committee, unlike a bill that you can amend, I presume. When the map comes, you can't just amend a map because of the population. Does it require another plan, or how does that work?
Representative Marquardt, this is no different than any other bill. If you wanted to amend any map that was brought forward to this committee, you could.
Madam Chair.
Representative Marquardt.
So at that time, if somehow we have the calculations of the populations, we could literally... When the map is brought, I mean, how does, I haven't been through this before. My question is, and this is, when a map is brought forward, I presume at some point, is one map brought forward, or are there several maps brought forward, and then we vote on which map, or how does that work? Because I presume once a map gets brought forward, you really can't just at that moment take out the pencil and start redrawing lines on proposed amendments. I mean, how does that work exactly?
Representative Marquardt, it's no different than any other committee, any other bill. Any map could be, we schedule a hearing to discuss a map plan. If you wanted to have an amendment to that map plan, no different than what we're doing here today. You could post your amendment, provided it meets the 24-hour rule, and you could have 10 different amendments to that map. It's entirely up to you.
So, Madam Chair, then I presume an amendment basically would be another map.
Potentially,
I guess would be probably be the amendment. Then, once a map is approved out of this committee, does it go straight to the House floor, or are there other committees that will see it?
It gets referred to the General Register.
Okay, so, Madam Chair, we go straight to the House floor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, on that point, is the plan a written plan? And are we amending the written plan and the language? Or are we amending a map?
Mr. Gearing, can you respond to Representative Murphy?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, the vehicle bill that will be the ultimate plan that's considered by the House is a written bill that refers to a specifically named map file that is posted online. And so the LCC and the GIS staff will post any plan that is submitted by a legislator to the web, and you'll be able to see the map with the districts drawn in the map, as well as all of the plan component reports that we've been talking about with the principals today. The bill that will actually be in front of the committee when it comes to the committee will be just a couple of sentences, and it will say the redistricting plan enacted for the state of Minnesota is Plan L-XXX, whatever the number will be for that plan. And so if you had an amendment, your amendment would be a different plan to that bill.
Representative Murphy.
And Madam Chair, is there a timeline that you have in mind that we are going to be able to know when the plan is going to come out, and will there be the opportunity more than 24 hours to make an amendment?
Well, Representative Murphy, you know, that's why it's helpful for us to be doing these principles today, because that obviously helps you in putting together a map that is abides by the principles. And I'd like to ask you the same thing. What is your timeline as far as any map that you're looking to do at all? Or that's something that I had asked last week, too. I didn't know if you had any thoughts. I think at that point you said you have a map. And I'm just curious if that's changed or where you're at in the process.
Madam Chair, I don't believe I said I had a map.
Oh, then I misunderstood.
Because I have not seen a map.
Representative Murphy. Okay. Well.
That would be interesting.
I said we were working on principles and we were working on some profiles.
Okay.
I believe that's what I said. I really don't have a map.
Okay.
But I presume that I better have one pretty quick, huh? But I don't understand, you know, it's not, I don't see how it's possible to make an amendment to a map within a 24-hour period.
Well, Representative...
Since I don't have a map yet, and we've been practicing on something or another with the 2010 population kind of things for a while, but I don't have a 2011 new one, and I know I couldn't have it ready by tomorrow.
Well, Representative Murphy, I think history will show you, though, that when it comes to the redistricting process, there hasn't seemed to have been any shortage as far as people coming up with amendments to maps in the past, House committees and Senate committees and so forth. So, but, you know, certainly we are at some point going to be voting on maps, so if you haven't thought about that process, obviously you're going to you want to look into that.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative
Murphy.
I have been thinking about it, and I was wondering when we were going to start talking about it together as a group. I thought the idea, when you and I talked on public radio and Gary Eitan the first day, we said that we thought we could come up with a map.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, we haven't discussed within this committee which directions we should go with our maps.
Well, I would
and so
with
are we going to just have a map put down before us and then you're going to expect a map in return, or are we ever going to talk about the parameters of doing one together?
Well, Representative Murphy, that's the point of today's hearing, is the principles that does lay out the parameters together as a group. That's why we're having this discussion today.
Mm-hmm.
So, we have a roll call. Any other comments, members? Representative Hortman?
Well, just in the discussion of the proceedings, you know, I just don't want anybody to forget how great the 813 amendment was, because we were talking about that before we started talking about the process. But, I mean, and the reason why this started that whole conversation is, you know, we'd really like to know how the process works once a map has been developed. And this gets to it, and this would answer the question. The public would know, the DFL would know, the Republicans would know, that everybody would have a week to give us some feedback before we were to adopt a plan. I'm sure there's people in your caucus who would like an opportunity to weigh in before you take action. I'm sure they would like more than 24 hours or more than 3 days. And I know that there are people in the public who would like an opportunity to weigh in, and this would tell them how much time they had.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question was just to try to get to an answer for Representative Murphy. What is the timeline?
Well, like I said, we got the census data in March. If you haven't begun the process of looking at putting together a map, I would assume that you have. I know I've had conversations with Representative Poppy. She's looked at her area quite a bit. I know that other members have discussed the issue with me, Representative Rukavina and Representative Anzelk. So I've had comments from them as well. So I just assume that you guys have looked at this, and if you haven't, I encourage you to do so. So. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we appreciate the encouragement, but we would kind of like an answer back, like, what is your plan to put a map before us? Maybe that's the more direct way to say it.
Well, sometime in May, Representative Clark, putting a plan before folks is the ideal.
Madam Chair.
Representative Clark.
May is a long month. Are we talking about the first week, second week?
Well, you can back yourself out, Representative Clark. I think what's the last day of session? April 23rd? May 23rd?
Yeah.
So before May 23rd.
Oh, come on. Madam Chair.
I can't give you a specific date.
at this time.
Madam Chair, can you give us a week of those 4 weeks?
I'll give you, and like I said, you've got the month of May. You've got 23 days. Sometime in 23 days of May, that's when it's going to happen. So.
Okay, Madam Chair. You know, I think we're trying to be cooperative here. I mean, it would just be helpful to get a little more sense, and I don't know. This community, I feel like, I mean, I know that you're new at this, but it would just be helpful to have a little bit more mutual, you know, sharing of information, and actually it comes down to respect, you know. I mean, just to have us, you know, sharing with each other. I don't think what's being asked is anything unreasonable.
I will share it with you as soon as I know it, Representative Clark. That's the issue that it comes down to.
Okay.
So, you know, when we're able to, you know, put this all together, get the principles in place, know that what our parameters are, that's the key thing. So that's why we're having this conversation today. Representative Poppy.
This is away from the amendment, so I don't know if you want to okay. deal with that first. I just had another question about.
All right. Let's vote on the A13 amendment. Ms. Hensing.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Fabian?
No.
Representative Clark?
Yes.
Representative Doubt?
No.
Representative Garofalo?
No.
Representative Hoppe?
No.
Representative Hortman?
Yes.
Representative Loon?
No.
Representative Marcor?
Yes.
Representative Murphy?
Yes.
Representative Poppy?
Yes.
And Representative Scott's absent. Failed.
Amendment failed. Representative, let's see, that's all your amendments for that.
I do have something to say before we get to passage, sure. But if you have other amendments.
And so we are on Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted the clarification then. We do need to get it done this year, right? I mean, that was with all the maps and everything and the timelines that Mr. Gearing has given us. So we are looking at May 23rd of this year. We don't really have the opportunity to go into next year at all to do it. I just for my own timeline.
On a technical level, we could do it next year as well, because the courts do not take control over this process until February 21st of 2012. Okay. However, that said, I would like to pass a bill before this session ends on May 23rd. So, yep.
Madam Chair.
Representative Murphy.
We also would like to pass a bill.
Yes.
Before May 23rd.
Sounds good. Any other comments before we vote on the bill? Representative Hortman.
Well, members, I would encourage a no vote at this point in time. I think that it's very important that we have redistricting principles that guide the drafting of a plan, but I think that the language at 2.5 through 2.7 actually violates 0.5 through 2.7 actually violates the Voting Rights Act in part because of the word concentrating, and I think it gets at people's 14th Amendment right to equal protection under the law. When we get sworn in, we take an oath to uphold the Constitution of the State of Minnesota and the United States of America, and I take that oath very seriously, and I don't think that this bill, as drafted, as amended, complies with the United States Constitution. So I would encourage a no vote.
Any other comments? Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, in House File 1547, as you introduced it last Monday, we talked about, or you had in there, data ready and plans posted. We submitted an amendment that is more detail, and you said we were going to talk about that amendment at this committee meeting.
Yes. Yep, you are correct, Representative.
At least could we have Mr. Mueller explain the process of what's done to posting plans?
Well, actually, what we'll do here, Representative Murphy, is we're going to first pass the or vote on the House File 1547, and then what we'll do is we're going to vote on the joint concurrent or the House concurrent resolution, and then we'll get to the GIS office to talk about the process that they have in posting plans. So we are on House File 1547 as amended by the DE1 amendment.
Is there a roll call?
Madam
you want
Chair.
A roll call? Okay, well, I'll put a roll call on there. Representative Murphy.
I see we lost most of our people, but we're not having any more discussion on this as a whole.
Oh, yes, you are correct. If there's anybody else from the audience that would like to provide input on this? Seeing none, we'll proceed to vote on the House File 1547 as amended. Ms. Hensing.
Representative Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Fabian?
Aye.
Fabian. Representative Clark?
No.
Representative Dowd?
Aye.
Representative Garofalo?
Yes.
Representative Hoppe?
Yes.
Representative Portman?
No.
Representative Loon?
Aye.
Representative Marquardt?
No.
Representative Murphy?
No.
Representative Hoppe?
No.
Representative Scott passed.
Okay, the House File 1547 as amended passed and is recommended to go to the General Register. Okay. Members, we are on the House Concurrent Resolution.
Ma'am, Chair, will that just be immediately reported out to the...
Beg your pardon?
Will that immediately be reported out and be on the blue sheets?
The House File 1547 as amended?
Yeah.
We'll file the committee report and, yes, send it to the Chief Clerk's office. Yep. Okay. And let's see. Okay, on the House Concurrent Resolution, it is the same as the House File 1547 as amended. We do have the Delete Everything Amendment that is the same as the Delete Everything Amendment that we did just moments ago. So I am first going to move the DE1 Amendment to House Concurrent Resolution Number 2. And members, this is just taking a different route. The first option sends it to the governor's office. Hopefully the governor signs it, since four out of the five items that he highlighted in his letter to us are addressed in our principles. What the House Concurrent Resolution does, if all else fails, then at least the legislative bodies are bound by principles, because we want to make sure that we have principles in place that we operate off of. So that's the point of the House Concurrent Resolution. And with that, I'll stand for any questions to the DE1 amendment to the House Concurrent Resolution Number 2. Representative Hortman.
I have a question, and it was probably for Mr. Gehring. In this concurrent resolution, we're adopting the number of districts, and I know past legislation has put the number of districts in the actual legislation. What's the difference of the impact between the doing it in the legislation versus a concurrent resolution?
Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, Representative Portman, the number of districts is actually already established in separate sections of statute, which is why you didn't see them in House File 1547, because this is a resolution that's binding the process for the legislature to create districts. We're just adding in the number that the legislature is going to create, and it's consistent with what's in statute.
Thank you.
Members, any other questions? Okay, seeing none, we will proceed to vote on the DE1 Amendment to House Concurrent Resolution Number 2. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
No.
Okay, the amendment passes. We are on the House Concurrent Resolution. I know, Representative Hortman, you have the same amendments. Are you going to proceed with those or no?
I do, Madam Chair, no, but I would just recommend that people vote no for the same reason. There's a lot of problems. I think the equal population 1% is too tight. I think that the language in the preserving communities of interest is not broad enough. But my primary reason for voting no is the way that paragraph B of minority representation is phrased.
Okay. Members, I encourage a yes vote for all the reasons that I cited earlier. And with that, do we have a roll call on it, or do you want to have a roll call on it or no? Okay. All right. All those in favor of House Concurrent Resolution Number 2 as amended and recommended to pass to the floor, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
amendment, the House Concurrent Resolution Number 2 passes. Okay, now we are down to posting plans on the web. If Mr. Millier, if you would mind joining us and talk to us a little bit about that process, what you've done in the past. It's Millier, isn't it? I always say it wrong. I apologize. Familiar, Millier. That's what I have to remember.
A good French pronunciation.
If you could walk us through, Mr. Millier, on how it worked.
Well, first thing we do is we receive a block equivalency file from any member who is submitting a plan. And using the block equivalency file, we process the plan, which this entails creating maps, statewide map, a metro area map, and then individual maps of each district. And we also create a series of reports, the population summary report, split subdivisions, total minority population, voting age minority population, contiguity, incumbents, compactness, and plan components. And we post all of these on the web. Each plan has its own individual page. There's an interactive map also involved with each plan where somebody can type in an address to see which district they might be in. They can click on the map to see to get statistics on districts. And that's basically it.
Okay. Members, any questions? Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, does the amendment or does the legislation that we had just adopted include under that data section, include all these things that he has said?
Representative Murphy, in the language it is on, let me look here. If you look at subdivision 10, it talks about what must be considered in the plans, and it asks for the block equivalency file. As far as the reports that are created by the GIS office, that's something that we provide a direction to the GIS office on the reports that are created. And we want to make sure that every plan has the same reports so that we are comparing apples to apples versus apples to oranges. So, but in the on the bill that we just passed out of here, it does say that we have to provide them with the block equivalency file to their office and that it's been filed with their director.
And
Representative Murphy.
And so, Madam Chair, in when you were speaking of the various sources or the people that were going to be submitting plans and how many, the various plans, how are they going to know what the directions are that you are speaking of?
We will communicate to the entire committee what the reports that are created for each plan that is submitted. And this, I think, what you've got here on the item here, I think, will be helpful to us in knowing what reports that you are looking to have created for this process.
Will you be providing a model?
We can provide you, yes, we can provide you with a list of what would be included in those reports, yes. Mm-hmm. Members, any other questions? Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Mr. Mueller, how much time do you need to post your, to gather the, to receive the information and post it.
Mr. Melia.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, we're requesting approximately 3 hours.
3 hours.
Yeah.
Representative Murphy. Members, any other questions? Representative Clark.
I was looking on page 1.25. It's not public until it's released by the member who provided the release of the plan. And would that be you, Madam Chair, for the one that we're waiting for from you? Is that
right? Representative Clark, are you looking at the A14?
Yeah.
Okay. And you're looking at 1.25? You treat it as non-public to the member who provided. No, it says.
The timeline there again.
Representative Clark, if you look at the language that they have in this amendment, it says until the member who provided it releases the plan for publication. And I would abide by that, that if you wanted to submit a plan to the GIS office, you would be the one that would determine when that plan would be released.
So Madam Chair, I presume you'll be the one who will be submitting the plan or someone on your committee? On your
any Representative Clark, any of us can submit a plan to the GIS office.
Madam Chair, I understand that.
Representative Clark.
But I think what we were trying to talk about is when the, I guess, when the plan will be ready. Will it come to this committee? It will have already, I'm trying to understand, when we see a map, it will have already been submitted to the GIS office for them to get it prepared?
Correct.
Okay. And they will, if they get it some period of time, they will sit on it until, for example, your map or the map from Arcox until there's a release. And is that correct? So is that expected? I guess my question would be, will that be before we have the hearing? That might be one way that, you know, the public would have a little more opportunity if it would be released before we have the committee hearing.
Well, Representative Clark, you know, you'll receive a 3-day notice on the committee discussing maps when that comes to that point. If you have an amendment, you have the 24-hour rule that, you know, you would have to have that in place so that we could see whatever map. If you as an individual wanted to create a map, you could go to the GIS office and say, hey, this is my map, this is what I want to see done. And you could set the time of when you wanted that map released, provided it meets the 24-hour rule.
And I don't think I was very clear.
Representative Clark.
What I meant was, I was just trying to figure out if there might be some room in here for the public to get a little look at the map, you know, before we have our hearing.
Representative Clark, it will be posted to the redistricting website, so the public has access to that and would be able to see it 24 hours in advance, or if you were to release it sooner than that, they'd be able to see it sooner than that. It's up to you on what the time frame you would want to use.
And Madam Chair, it's up to you on the time frame that you want to use, and am I understanding that you intend to do it 24 hours before the committee, or haven't you decided yet?
Well, at first got to put together the map, Representative Clark.
I understand. I'm just trying to, you know, there are people who are very interested in this, as has been talked about, and I'm just wondering what we can tell them. They can go to the website, and at least 24 hours ahead of time, they'll have a chance to look at it.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yep.
But not necessarily any time before that.
Correct.
Yep.
Members, any other questions or comments? All right. Thank you, Mr. Miller. And members,
Madam Chair,
Representative Murphy.
I would like to invite you to meet with the DFL members of the committee at a time convenient to all of us.
Sure. You bet, Representative Murphy. With that, members, we are adjourned.